Welcome to the Canadian Real Estate Investor, where hosts Daniel Foch and Nick Hill navigate the market and provide the tools and insights to build your real estate portfolio.
Welcome back to another episode of the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast. And here on the podcast, we cover all things, you guessed it, Canadian real estate. We look at investing fundamentals, stories and lessons from industry titans and thought leaders, how to make money in real estate. And we also analyze macroeconomic trends and talk about the latest news and all of the reports on the Canadian market.
We also have the occasional guest on who's an expert in things that we are not experts in or can legally not talk in detail about. Things like accounting, law, partnership structures, being a billionaire. We have no idea what that is like, at least not yet.
Not yet anyways, yeah. And if you just found us and started listening, thank you. We hope you enjoy. My advice is go back and listen to all the episodes from the beginning. We have episodes that cover all the basic stuff like real estate investing terms that you need to know and the different types of mortgages, how to buy a portfolio versus build a portfolio, how to pick a market. But we also have more complicated stuff, like one of the more recent episodes we just did on how the mortgage bond market is affecting the housing market when we get deeper into the macro stuff. So a little bit of content for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's our goal, is to make this kind of a universal Canadian real estate podcast, keep it interesting for people of all ages, shapes, and sizes. If you're a faithful listener, thank you. You've helped us grow this podcast, which has changed our lives, absolutely, is now helping us change other people's lives as well. And if you like what you hear, please go and leave us a review.
Yeah, exactly, Dan. And that, just like our friend artist Aaron did on Apple Podcasts, she wrote, insightful and to the point, 5 stars. These gentlemen know what they are talking about. This podcast has been extremely insightful, thought-provoking, and helpful in understanding the current Canadian landscape when it comes to real estate. Great job and keep up the good work. Well, thank you very much, Artist Aaron. Much appreciated. So, Dan, let's get into today's episode. What are we talking about?
So today we're going to talk about, I think we'll start off with this report from a real estate group called Royal LePage, which sheds light on how many Canadians currently invest in real estate and how many plan to invest in real estate. Then we're going to look at the Canadian Real Estate Association, better known as CREA, and their market report and statistics.
Yeah, I love it. Let's dive in. So we'll start with the highlights from the Royal LePage report. But before we do that, Dan, did you know, because I believe at one point in your life you were at Royal LePage, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know that they are a Canadian real estate franchisor, so owned and operated here in Canada with more than 670 locations, over 20,000 realtors in Canada, and the company was founded all the way back in 1913 in Toronto, center of the universe here, by a 26-year-old named Albert Edward LePage under the name of, and I love this, A.E. LePage, Bungalow Specialist.
There you go.
What kind of specialist? Would you call yourself a duplex specialist, duplex daddy? I remember when we were going to make those t-shirts.
Yeah, I was thinking about that being my branding, actually. Bungalow's a good thing to be a specialist in. I mean, I guess that's all it took to differentiate before back in the day. It's a good thing he didn't keep it as that name, to be fair. So I appreciate the history lesson anyway. So let's dive into some of the highlights from the report here. So more than 1 in 4 Canadians plan to purchase an investment property in the next 5 years, according to this Royal LePage report. So 51% of current investors and 23% of non-investors are considering buying an investment property before 2028. So do you, I guess I can read these survey highlights and then you'll give me some commentary on it. Approximately 4.4 million Canadians currently own an investment property, and all of them listen to this show. That was a joke.
I wish.
We just hit 1 million downloads, actually. So maybe when we hit 4.4 million downloads, we could imagine that 100% of investors listen to our show. 26% of all Canadians say that they are likely to buy an investment property within the next 5 years. 1/3 of Canadian real estate investors, so 32%, just shy of 1/3, own two or more properties. So that would be kind of your power users, your bigger investors. Younger investors, those aged 18 to 34, are more likely to own more than one investment property compared to their older counterparts. That's an interesting one, eh?
Yeah, you know, as a 34-year-old, I still really love that I'm grouped into that younger category of 18 to 34, because me and all the 18-year-olds just have so much in common these days.
Yeah, you're basically a Gen Z, or that's what it is, right? Bussin', no cap and all that, floppy top hair, you got a perm.
Something like that. Yeah, no, but this one is really interesting, and we get more into it later. So let's pause the conversation on that right now, because my next piece right here is all about younger Canadians. But Dan, hit me with the rest of the survey highlights here.
Sure. Nearly one third of investors in Canada, 31%, have considered selling one or more of their investment properties due to higher lending rates. 20% of investors in the greater Montreal area say they are likely to sell one or more of their investment properties within the next 2 years. This percentage rises to 24% and 28% in the greater regions of Toronto and Vancouver.
Well, well, well. I wonder why people in Toronto and Vancouver are feeling more stressed than people in greater Montreal. That's because everything is seemingly double the cost in Vancouver and Toronto than everywhere else. Now, going back to that interesting piece about the younger investors, the next piece of the report here goes on to say that young Canadians are actually more inclined than ever to invest. So although a lot of us, and I can say that because I fit into that 18 to 34 category, although many of us young Canadians are struggling to get our foot into the property ladder, the youngest group of real estate investors, those 18 to 34 year olds, are most likely to have more than one residential property compared to their older counterparts. 44% of the youngest investor cohort own two or more investment properties. So almost half. It's crazy. And that's significantly higher than those aged 35 to 24, which in about 8 months, I will be part of that next cohort, and those 55 or older, which is only 25%. 67% of younger investors, again, that's the 18 to 34 year olds, own their primary residence compared to 88 and 95% that are in that 35 to 54 or 55 and older. Now, that makes a lot of sense. You'd expect those 35 to 55 plus people that likely have families or have just moved out of the city, maybe want more space and primary residence was important to them. Or maybe they've done the smart thing and bought a bunch of cash flow in real estate and then invested. So Phil Soper, the president and CEO of Royal LePage, was quoted saying, "We know that the value of home ownership in Canada is strong among Canadians. It's clear that possessing real estate remains a desirable means for building wealth over time. Many choose to invest in real estate not only as a way of generating income and reaping the benefits of value appreciation, but to provide an opening into the market for future generations of their family." Now, Dan, remember we actually both made Instagram videos about it. The number one way to ensure that you are going to be a homeowner in Canada is if your parents are homeowners. So, and that I believe was a CMHC or a Stats Canada report where that data comes from.
Yeah, it was a Statistics Canada report, I believe, which was just showing the impact of the likelihood that you were to own real estate if your parents owned real estate.
Exactly. So all of these 18 to 34 year olds are figuring, hey, I better buy so that my kids are part of that next statistic when Stats Canada redoes that.
Yeah, well, I think if you're just assuming like time, not even appreciation, but just purely time. Like if you're paying down a mortgage, then you have equity. And I guess even if the property grows at inflation, you would also have equity. And so the likelihood that people are able to tap that equity to now purchase, help their children purchase, or, you know, purchase an investment property or whatever it is, increases, right? Because like the more equity that you have, the more money you have, the more likely you are to. And there's another stat that was recently released. I got to look it up, but Terranet, I guess it is, like the land registry system, puts out the percentage of multi-property owners. It said like what percentage of people is are owned by investors. I think it was like just shy of 30% of properties in the GTA. I think was it GTA or Ontario?
I think it was Ontario.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I just was looking at that stat the other day. Phil Soper, president and CEO of Royal LePage, goes on to say that despite the hurdles of low home supply and increased lending rates, young people are more inclined than ever to make real estate investing a part of their financial planning for the future. In fact, survey results tell us that many of them are actually prioritizing investment properties over owning their own primary residence. Now, that sounds very familiar to me because that is exactly what I've decided to do. And contrary to popular belief, I think it's becoming a more and more common consideration. I recently met up with an old mentor of mine. He came by my apartment before we went out to lunch and he was like, oh, great place. You know, did you buy it? And I said, hell no, I only buy properties right now that cash flow, because if I bought this place, you know, there goes a lot of my cash reserves. So great to see that more people are making the leap into investing here. Now, Dan, I know you just pulled something up, but you're going to tell me about what types of property, what asset classes a lot of these investors are buying.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just the stat that we were just mentioning. Investors own 23.7% of Ontario homes, the report says. It's funny. Yeah, I was just reading the Reddit thread. It says like corporations should not own homes. It's that simple. It's like, well, like a corporation, like in most cases, is just a person who started a corp, right?
Like, yeah, it's not every corporation is BlackRock, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, this is before we move on, because I this is one of those things that's really I found to be a little bit confusing. It's like not everyone wants to own a house. Like you just mentioned this too. You know, you don't want to own the house that you live in. You want to rent it. And so, who else is gonna like? You know, who else is going to rent these? Like, I think people who hate landlords don't realize that they also might hate tenants, right? Like, for being part of the system. It's like, how dare you rent from a corporate landlord? I just, the thing's kind of, it's always been confusing to me because I think the logic doesn't necessarily check out 100%. But anyway, I digress, as is tradition. The report goes on to say across Canada, single-family detached homes are the most popular type of investment property, with 44% of real estate owners or real estate investors in owning this type of home. And maybe that's fair context when people are saying corporations should not own homes. It's that simple. I'm reading this, going back to this Reddit comment. Maybe it does make more sense for corporations to own multifamily dwellings, not single-family homes. But then it still begs the question, well, are tenants not allowed to have single family homes then, right? So anyway, condominiums are the second most popular type of investment. 37% of real estate investors would own that type, followed by townhomes, 11%. According to the survey, Canadian real estate investors report that the opportunity for property value appreciation over the long term, 69%, that was the primary driving factor, which is, I mean, I think we knew that. It's just interesting to see it represented in data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's wrong, guys. That should not be the main leading way. Yeah.
Positive cash flow on a monthly basis was the second highest incentive, which was 54% of respondents.
Now we're talking.
And low maintenance costs or variable expenses, 44%, ranked as the top three priorities when buying their residential investment properties. 44% of real estate investors say their investment property is located in a different town or city than where they currently live, which is interesting. If you listen to the show, you know that we're proponents of investing in markets other than your own, simply because in a lot of cases, like Nick's a really good example. Nick's landlord is probably losing money. And, you know, because the cost.
Hopefully she is not a listener to the show.
But like realistically, you know, if somebody's owning a downtown condo at current interest rates and prices and condo fees, the chances of them being cash flow positive at current rents in the city of Toronto are not super high. And so let that be somebody else's problem. Nick can get close to the action. He's got a suite unit, you know, can walk to pretty much everything. And he owns properties in other municipalities where he actually makes money. So be like Nick. There's a Nick, do you have a course on how to be like you? It's called the Nictionary course.
That'll be after Realist. That's the next course that I'm launching.
That should be the next session.
There's no room in it. Unfortunately, there's no room in it for you, but,
what's that meme? Like, it's just like, yeah, be like Nick. That's it. Anyway, access to a post-secondary educational institution is also a major factor. So obviously, potentially student rental.
A lot of student rentals. Yeah.
With 47% of investors reporting that proximity to a major Canadian university or college motivated their decision to buy in a particular location. So I would posit to the Reddit thread people who say that investors shouldn't own homes where these students might live in their version of reality. That would just be my question. I would love for somebody to actually answer some of these questions for me. Maybe we can have a debate. I don't know if it would fit very well on this show, but it would fit very well somewhere. I'll tell you that much for free because it would be very entertaining.
we'll work that into one of the live events we have.
Sounds like a protest waiting to happen.
Yeah, seriously. There's one last piece that I want to touch on, and I do want to go back and touch on a few of these points because, Dan, you and I make up and fit into some of these statistics as young people and as investors. And then just really interesting on the student, you know, almost 50% of investors are close to schools. Well, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, we know what happened with the ridiculous amount of student rental and, you know, increases into all the different colleges. So let's put that on hold while I just get this last piece out of the way. Then we can close that conversation out before moving on to the CREA stats here. The increased borrowing cost has obviously had a significant impact on a particular group of people, and those are variable mortgage holders in Canada, specifically over the past year and a half. And if those investment properties were on that variable rate, then you are unfortunately definitely feeling the effects. Even if you're lucky and your property is still cash flowing, it is definitely cash flowing a hell of a lot less than it did at the, you know, 1% and 2% range. So increased lending rates have caused nearly 1/3 of investors, 31% to be exact, to consider selling at least one of their properties, if not more. Now, investors in that my age group, the 18 to 34 year olds, and Dan, yours as well, are more likely to weigh the decision of selling one of their investment properties, one of their lesser performing investment properties. And we're up at 54%. And that's an interesting takeaway because to me, that means, you know, there's a lot of people thinking, hey, if it's not working, I'm going to sell it. And we just talked about this in the Warren Buffett episode where we're like, if you're in a sinking ship, don't try to spend your time with a cup, you know, getting all the water out, right? It might be time to let that ship sink and take your energy to another ship, ships being houses, investment properties in this case. So,
you know what? Somebody asked us a really good question on this in our emails. We love getting good questions in our emails, by the way. So keep them coming. But I'm just going to answer it on the show now because the question was like, you guys mentioned that investors who are at a loss should consider selling, or I think it said that it should sell. I would never actually give the blanket advice that somebody should sell. I would need to understand their individual situation. So let's just put that there. But then he was saying further in the question that maybe you can look up this email too, so we can mention the person's name so that they know that we're addressing them at the end. But I think they'll know from just hearing the question. But it was like, but you're also saying that that we need development charges to be reduced for developers to be able to build housing. And it's like, why wouldn't you tell them that they need to sell? And I was like, you know, this is a great question, right? Because their developers are left with an unviable investment here as well as investors. And my answer to the question would be, I would actually tell developers who are unviable to sell, except most of them can't because the nature of development depends on them creating that value, creating those units in order to liquidate the loan. So they can't just sell because they probably owe too much money and they would be in a negative equity position. Not like, well, maybe now because property values have come down, but just based on the pure nature, because you have to, I'll just give you a quick supply chain on development. You buy land, you entitle it. So you go get like zoning bylaw amendment, site plan approval, et cetera. Now it's worth more because the output of it is improved. And so you borrow against part of that value that you've created, and you also collect deposits from potential purchasers and insure those deposits and then go and get construction financing. And in order to do that, you need people to buy those units, and now you have an obligation to deliver those units. And so a developer is a little bit different because if they just sold or quit or whatever, then it would be a failure to create units, but there would also be collateral damage to all of those potential purchasers. Now, to return to the original question, because it is a great question, I actually don't think that the best option for everyone is to sell a money-losing property. I think it is. So my thing is, don't get stuck with a bad asset. It's always a bad time to own a bad asset. And most people are thinking, oh, I'm in acquisition mode. I said this in the course recently. The next couple of modules that I'm going to do are on strategy and maximization of your existing portfolio. And so if you own a cash negative single family house in the greater Toronto area, if you add a unit to that, you can probably increase the rents on the upper story and increase the rents on the lower story and increase the value of the property all at the same time. If you add a detached ADU as an example, which is going to be a huge theme that you're going to hear on this show, I think for the next 12 to 24 months, because it is such a huge value creation opportunity that's very almost instantaneous. It's becoming more financeable, as you know, from some of the conversations that we've been mentioning that we've been having on the show. That's another huge opportunity for you to create more revenue and build more equity into your property. So my advice isn't always to sell a property that's losing money. It's my first advice would be, if the ship that Nick is describing can be fixed, like if you can plug the hole or, you know, plug the hole and bail it out, that would be a better option than trying to swim to shore, right? And jumping ship. But if you can't do that, and it's not a hard exercise to actually run the numbers on cost benefit, am I going to get out of trouble here? No. Okay. Now I know the best option is to get rid of this thing. Can I bail myself out here? Yes. Okay. That's what I'm going to do, right? It's just a fork in the road. You run the numbers on each situation and you do the better option. Cost benefit analysis, not rocket science.
Yeah. No, really, really well said, Dan. I think it goes back to show that just, you know, there's no real good blanket statement in real estate, right? Hey, it's always a good time to buy. It's always a good time to sell. Both incorrect. You know, real estate always goes up. Incorrect. What it really comes down to is everything is very nuanced and subjective to that person, their portfolio, their goals, their risk tolerance, and more. And that's one of the things that, again, you know, you mentioned the course. That's one of the things we've been doing in the course is almost portfolio audits, where we'll go literally building by building, asset by asset, and being like, what's this performing at? What are your pain points here? How can we make this one better? So yeah, well said. Completely agree. You think it, let's keep moving here and,
yeah, let's do that.
Maybe get to the Kriya stats.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, based off of that conversation and a lot of other conversations, it's pretty obvious that the Canadian real estate market stands as one of the cornerstones of Canada's economy, right? We've talked about it numerous times, how much it makes up of GDP, how much, I mean, even just this article, right? Like the Roy LePage report, 1 in 4 Canadians want in. So it reflects not only the economic conditions, but also societal shifts and demographic patterns. So we can learn a lot about Canadians by studying how they interact with real estate.
Yeah. So I had mentioned in this article this is an article that I wrote for Real Estate Magazine, by the way, if you want to read it, there's some charts in it and stuff like that. But I do this on a monthly basis. I do Canadian real estate stat, Kriya stats, and I also do Toronto Real Estate Board stats, which I think we're going to start rolling those back into more regular episodes, both Toronto and Kriya, because we've found that Toronto seems to serve as a pretty good leading indicator, canary in the coal mine on what's going to happen on a national level, probably because it's 60% of the national data set. But, you know, also it does seem to lead, like you see capital contraction here and now all of a sudden Torontonians are broke. So they're no longer going and playing around and having bidding wars for fun in Halifax or whatever, you know? So anyway, I was surprised by the resilience that we've seen against the various challenges, including a looming recession, record interest rate hikes, and economic stagnation almost reminiscent of Japan's lost decade, which, you know, I mean, we're looking at almost 10 years of negative economic progress now at this point, where our GDP per capita is now at 2016 levels. Nick and I just put out a chart on that. A lot of people were angry in the comments, but basically the idea is, I mean, if your GDP per capita hasn't grown in 8 years, you're almost at a lost decade, right? So anyway, unforeseen strength against the recessionary pressures. House prices in Canada were unchanged since last month, but they're still down 2.3% since 3 months ago and down 4.6% since 6 months ago. When looking at a more long-term context, the house price index tells us that we are up 1.2% in a year. So you're up a little bit. And just like that's worth noting that that's below inflation. And so on a real basis, adjusted for inflation, real house prices didn't actually grow, right? They actually fell. So you're losing money to inflation on the real estate asset if your asset went up 1.2% because it's not outpacing inflation. They're up 13% since 3 years ago. When looking at house prices in the shorter term, it's understandable why market participants have confusion about the market. The average house price is trending up on a month-over-month basis, yet the MLS HPI or house price index benchmark is trending down. And so there's this book that I like to reference a lot. It's called How to Lie with Statistics. But you could literally have a headline this month that says HPI house prices are going up, house price index is going down, and you could say, oh, the house prices are falling. Or you could also say the average house price is going up. And so this is where data is, and the proper interpretation of data is so important in my perspective, because real estate's tough as a legitimate principal agent problem, because they're agents, where the people who are telling you this information in a lot of cases are also invested in making a transaction take place because their income depends on it. And so you really do have to be careful with this information. So anyway, on top of that, CREA's headline says that house prices stopped falling, but I looked at the data that they put out and 30 markets saw a decrease in HPI value in Canada, while 24 markets saw a monthly increase in HPI and 2 markets remained unchanged. So more than half of the markets fell in value, even though the headlines on their website suggest Canadian house prices see a sudden end to declines in advance of the spring market. Typically, or while the declines may have stopped, I don't know if this is necessarily a good signal, because usually you would see house prices growing steadily in the spring, with prices growing from January to May, all 5 months, like in a pretty linear fashion in a typical year.
Yeah, exactly, Dan. And, you know, it's funny because despite this looming recession and, you know, the we might be in it right now and just not admitting it, but despite the looming recessionary pressures, the Canadian real estate market once again has defied expectations and actually shows signs of stability heading into the spring market here.
To be fair, I did write this before they changed the international students, but non-permanent residence rules. And I think that recoil of reducing the population, like, they actually are going to see, so currently non-permanent residents are 6.2% of the Canadian population. They want to get that number down to 5% of the population, which means that we're actually going to need to see a net outflow of like 400,000 non-permanent residents, which will have a significant economic impact from my perspective. So population growth was 1.2 million last year. Their target is going to be to try and keep it at like 400,000 for the next couple of years after that, for 3 years. You have to elect them if you want them to do it the 2 years after that. But anyway, house prices in Canada were unchanged since last month, but were down 2.3% since 3 months ago and 4.6%. Oh, I think I mentioned all this one. Actually, there's a bunch of it here. Let's get below the aggregate MLS HPI chart and actually go through the biggest monthly increases in house prices. So this is a list of the biggest.
This is what people want to hear anyway.
Yeah. This list is good because it allows us to go kind of more coast to coast, right? So the biggest monthly increases in house prices measured by the house price index are, drumroll please, Simcoe and District, 4.3%. So that's not Simcoe County, by the way. That's Simcoe and District, which is Simcoe City outside of Hamilton, like southwestern Ontario. Quebec CMA up 3.8%. Regina and Saskatoon up both 2.5%. And Winnipeg up 1.5%. The Prairie is just absolutely throwing down on these month-to-month price growth.
I don't even want to read 3, 4, and 5 because I don't want to let everyone know about, you know, our next moves here, which has become, you know,
yeah, I know,
Prairie Kings over there, ideally, because it's great to see. And, you know, that men lie, women lie, numbers don't.
Prairies don't.
Lil Wayne, well, original, they, right there.
Prairies do lie, actually, because they're very flat, I guess. So they lie.
I see what you did there. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And it's so funny because we've been doing the CREA stats now on the show for going on 2 years here, Dan. And, you know, there was a point where we were looking at some of these monthly increases and, you know, the number 5 was, you know, mid high double digits in the teens. And, it's nice to see things kind of come back to a reasonable level here. So that is the 5 biggest increases. Let's look at the 5 Ontario real estate markets that saw the biggest drop in house prices.
It's not even just that we're only looking at Ontario markets. All of the biggest drops were in Ontario. That's the why that was taken.
Yeah, this isn't by design. This is by the data. So we're not excluding anywhere else in the country. And this is something. This is a list that you don't want to be on. All right, so should feel happy about that. So again, the five Ontario markets that saw the biggest drop. Number one, Woodstock, Ingersoll down 3.5%. Windsor, Essex down 2.3%. Niagara region down 1.7%. North Bay down 1.7%. And Cambridge down 1.7% as well.
Yeah, North Bay is an interesting one. Like, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of this. These famous Canadian investors who owned a bunch of stuff out there, and I was reading the KSV filings, and they actually like can't sell off all of those assets in one fell swoop because they own so much real estate that it would draw down the market, which just was mind blowing from my perspective.
That is mind blowing
to own so much that you could accidentally pump and dump a market.
Yeah, really, it really is crazy. On that note, I have gotten some requests that we have certain individuals that were involved in certain things that were made the media. I've had requests that we get them on here and kind of do a investigative journalist approach to
no softball
what the hell
questions,
actually
though.
Happened there. No softball questions. I mean, to be fair, no deserved softball questions there. I think there's some explaining to do, but
I'm down.
We've got a great platform for it, and you know, certain parties have reached out and said they would be interested in doing that. So stay tuned for some true crime. All right.
Yeah. Well, no crime. We can't. But there
no
was
crime
just
yet.
True. I don't even know. It was just
true.
Just some
Canadian
wild west
moments.
Stuff.
I don't know.
Okay, so on a provincial basis, the biggest annual increases in average price can be seen in Alberta, New Brunswick, and Newfoundland. Not coincidentally, these markets have also been some of the biggest recipients of Ontario residents fleeing the province for more affordable markets. So again, that's if you're looking at an annual increase, so 1 year. The other ones that we're listing were just a monthly basis, which honestly, like, I don't really actually recommend using, except like if you're in current acquisition mode and you're like, oh wow, Windsor Essex just blew off by 2.5%. Maybe there's some distressed deals over there. I'm going to go and start knocking on some doors or whatever. But I really think like more, you know, most people think about price growth, they think about it on an annual basis because you're not like day trading real estate unless you're Nick Hill because he's a professional real estate day trader. But yeah, so those are
course coming out on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything you're talking about, Dan, has obviously a lot to do with record population growth. I mean, it played a pivotal role in bolstering housing demand and underpinning market activity, even amidst all the economic headwinds that we've experienced in the last few years. The growth and interprovincial migration patterns have contributed to sustained housing demand, countering downward pressure that typically accompany what we're likely in right now, a recession.
Yeah, and the response to the Bank of Canada's unprecedented series of interest rate hikes, you know, obviously they posed a significant challenge for the real estate market, which is traditionally sensitive to fluctuations in borrowing costs. We've been documenting this from the start. Like literally we started this show when the rate hikes just started, if not right before. Like we pretty much
said,
this is how it's going to play out. And man, we were like bang on, honestly, which was kind of crazy.
We've been right about a couple things.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling to be like, because I remember, go back and listen to episode 2 and understand that it took place in like, well, look when it came out. Was it like, it was May of that year, I think. But it was like, you know, 2022 price drops took place, you know, kind of followed the 90s curve. So anyway, I mean, we saw a lot of suffering as a result of the interest rate hikes, but the market has been resilient since then, especially in entry level product. Like you're hearing about bidding wars, houses, anything like under $1 million where CMHC insured is on fire right now. And we just did an episode about this, how the government of Canada is basically trying to prop up the housing market by issuing 50% more bonds and buying all of those bonds, or buying 50% of the supply of total bonds, which is all money that's going to go to either MLI Select, CMHC insured rental housing construction, because those are insured through mortgage bonds, or it's going to go to first-time homebuyers or owner-occupied homebuyers who are using high loan-to-value insured mortgages. So anybody with less than 20% down payment is going to have to use an insured mortgage. They're going to also benefit from the liquidity that's being added by the government here. And so that's why you're seeing that resilience from my perspective in the entry-level market. And also banks have kind of started stepping back a little bit on product that is has risk associated with it. And to be real, if your loans are insured, they have no risk. So if you're a bank, why would you not just take all of it? I still got to generate a return. Let's just start going to give money to first-time homebuyers. And so first-time homebuyers, owner-occupied, if you're buying with a CMHC-insured mortgage, give yourself a pat on the back. You are single-handedly propping up the Canadian real estate market right now.
Thank you for your efforts. Yeah, I mean, funny when you put it that way, Dan. Economic stagnation and its impact on housing. This is where we're going to talk about Canada's GDP per capita stagnation. Dan mentioned, if you have either of us on Instagram, at Daniel Foch, at my buddy Nick, we've really been putting out a lot of really cool interactive graphics recently. And this one, which is at over 400,000 views and I think 10,000 shares and many, many interesting comments in there, really sheds light on what's happening. And Dan has some great explanations as to why GDP per capita really does reflect standard living. So, you know, Dan compares it here to the reminiscent of Japan's lost decade. Now, Japan's got a very interesting housing market. So as an aside here, I did find this amazing paper on the Japanese housing market and kind of comparing it to Canada a little bit. So likely we'll have at least an episode or a segment of an episode on that in the coming weeks. So stay tuned for that. Now, despite nominal economic growth, when adjusted for population, GDP per capita has declined all the way back to 2016 levels. This is where we're talking about that lost decade, raising concerns about long-term economic prospects and affordability changes. And guess who's likely going to be affected most here? It's probably going to be the 18 to 34-year-olds that are trying to make their way through economy. Now, another little story here. I just listened to this really great New York Times podcast episode called It Sucks to Be 33. And it really showed how people born in 90 and 91 make up the biggest portion of the population in North America right now. Like we are the next biggest generation, just like the baby boomers were. So there is essentially a lot of us competing with one another to do things like get into the housing market, start families. And they made this really great analogy of all of us trying to put on a sweater that's a little too tight. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I've definitely done
that.
That's
actually such a bad, comfortable thing. A bad feeling, man. Like when sweaters shrink, it's over. Sweaters have to be
bad. Yeah, I mean, like your sleeves are a little up. I don't know, you know, if you know, you might have a little bit of a gut hanging out underneath and just, you know, you can't raise your arms above your head. No standing ovations or jumping up because it'll expose your stomach and it's just not a good feeling. And that's kind of where a lot of us, that 18 to 34 cohort is going to find ourselves over the next decade. So Dan, you've got a really interesting chart here before we kind of wrap things up.
I'm going to rip this quick and then I'm going to let you wrap up because I'm having a bladder emergency. So I'm going to step out of the digital studio here. So this is a chart from Ben Rabideau on Twitter. Prices nationally remain 14% below peak, which is minus 22% in real terms. Again, real being adjusted for inflation. Alberta, Saskatchewan and Newfoundland are still at record highs, which is cool and crazy. So if you look at Canada, 14%, BC down about just shy of 8%. Alberta, Saskatchewan all still are fine. Manitoba down about 5% from total. Ontario down almost 18% off peak. Crazy if you think off crazy. The peak there. Quebec down just slightly off peak, minus 3%. New Brunswick just under maybe 1%. Nova Scotia down about 4% and PEI down about 2%. So again, just context, if you're still thinking like, oh, stuff's overpriced, it was far more overpriced before. So like we're starting to see some good deals happen and some distress happen as a result of this change.
Yeah, for sure. And just to clarify, that Ontario is 18% off, but in real terms, it's over 25, it's 26%. So just to wrap things up here, the current state of the Canadian real estate market calls for cautious optimism. Now, that should be tempered by awareness of underlying challenges. So while the market has demonstrated resilience against recessionary pressures, record interest rate hikes, economic stagnation, vulnerabilities remain. Affordability concerns persist, particularly in major urban centers like we just discussed, and there is a need for policymakers and industry stakeholders to address these issues proactively now more than ever. the Canadian real estate market's resilience against a backdrop of economic uncertainty is both surprising and noteworthy. Factors such as record population growth, adaptability to those interest rate hikes, and demographic shifts have contributed to this unexpected strength and resilience. However, challenges remain. And again, those are affordability, economic stagnation, and more. And as we navigate these uncertain waters, careful monitoring of market indicators and strategic policy interventions will be essential to ensure the long-term health and sustainability of Canada's real estate sector. Wow, that author likes to get a little wordy at the end there, eh, Dan?
Yeah, I'd never heard of that guy, but good analysis for sure.
Great analysis. Another awesome article written by our very own Daniel Foch. So that was 1 in 4 Canadians want to buy an investment property. Great report by Royal LePage, the bungalow specialists over there, over 100 years ago. And then just our outlining of CREA stats, market updates, etc. Any final words, Dan?
No, not really. Make sure you get out to a meetup. Nick and I are actually going to be doing it. I think we're doing a contest. I'm trying to get more people to come to my, so we're going to like launch these meetups. Our goal is to eventually, as we start adding more and more meetups, to do this for everyone. So like, you know, if you're somebody who wants to host a meetup, we'll connect you with our events manager. And, you know, if you're come on as a partner on a 1-year contract, then we'll come out and launch it for you and, you know, help build the audience. That seemed to work really well for Calgary and Edmonton and stuff like that. Those are the two biggest meetups now, even bigger than Nick's meetup in Toronto. So what we're going to do is I'm going to go to Sudbury and Nick's going to go to Windsor. I think this is a goal, right? This is what we're going to do on April 9th.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And all of you who are listening are going to go to whatever meetup is in your city, but and we're going to see who gets more people. So far, you're absolutely crushing me, by the way. Like Windsor has so many people signed up. So Sudbury, please don't make me look bad and let's go out and everybody come and hang out and talk about real estate investing. And then, yeah, we'll let us know if you want us to come to your city and launch a monthly meetup. So these are monthly meetups. They take place on the first Tuesday of every single month.
Second
Tuesday. Oh, yeah. I don't know why I said that wrong. The second Tuesday of every single month. Thank you, Nick. Sorry, folks. That's why I haven't been at any meetups, because I've been going the wrong day. I was wondering why there was nobody there. Yeah. So, and you just go to meetup.com or the link in the show notes. You'll see a meetup.com link in the show notes and just find your city. If there isn't one in your city, give us a shout. We want to have one in every major market in Canada. We need partners to do that. Often realtors, mortgage brokers. We have an awesome national partner who we're going to be announcing very, very, very shortly. We're kind of rolling out a pilot on a couple of our local events. Are there ads running yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. So we can't announce it yet. Super secret, but super exciting. No. Very, very exciting. Perfect fit for us and for our audience. So I'll leave it at that. I've been rambling and I'll leave it on a high note with a little bit of a teaser there.
Love it. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you on the next one. The Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not financial advice. Nick Hill is a mortgage agent with Premier Mortgage Center and a partner in the G&H Mortgage Group. License number 10317, agent license M210040037.
Daniel Foch is a real estate broker licensed with RARE Real Estate, a member of the Canadian Real Estate Association, the Toronto Real Estate Board, and the Ontario Real Estate Association.